Welcome to Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast. I'm the creator and host, Andrew Rizza. I'm an allied healthcare professional that has worked in the industry for over 25 years, with the majority of my practice being in the private physical therapy space and in public school athletics. My curiosity prompted me to create Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast to discuss the ever-changing landscape in the healthcare industry, focusing on sports medicine, physical therapy, athletic training, and sports science. Each week, we will discuss the barriers that healthcare professionals face and how we as individuals can collaborate to make the listeners better understand the industry for a better patient and athlete experience. Now, on to the show. On this week's Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast, I'd like to invite Christina Haverty. Chris is the Assistant Vice President of Workforce Development and Global Engagement at LaSalle University in Newton, Massachusetts. With over 30 years of higher education experience as a practitioner, educator, and administrator, Chris provides leadership and strategic direction for the planning, delivery, and reporting of workforce training programs, customized skills development training, and community education programming activities responsive to industry-driven needs, both global and domestic. As the founding dean of the School of Health Sciences at LaSalle, she took an active role in creating an optimal educational experience for students of all levels, as well as for faculty. Chris supports students and faculty through global and domestic collaborations, professional development, advocacy, and academic program development. Chris's expertise in establishing global and domestic partnerships, developing educational experiences and programs, and accreditation led to the rapid expansion of the School of Health Sciences at LaSalle and the acquisition of partnerships in the field of sports, education, and healthcare. Before her 24 years at LaSalle, Chris was the coordinator of sports medicine at Massachusetts Institute of Technology in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and is an athlete trainer for the U.S. Soccer Federation. As an athlete training and exercise science educator, Chris's passion for active learning is the foundation for academic programs at the professional, undergraduate, and graduate levels, with a primary focus on student engagement, experiential learning, and the development of transferable professional skills. Chris earned her Bachelor's of Science degree in athletic training from Springfield College, her Master's of Education in Counseling Sports Psychology from BU, and her Doctorate of Philosophy in Leadership in Education from the University of Massachusetts Lowell. Welcome to Behind the Sports Medicine. Today I have Christina Haverty from LaSalle University joining us today, and we're going to talk about her journey as an athletic trainer into her role as a professor, department chair, and then into her new role now, which is a 360-degree spin from where she was. But still, I think there's a lot to be talked about today of the athletic training program, as this is National Athletic Training Month, and how she was very instrumental in transforming that program and making it what it is today, which is, I think, one of the best in New England. And we are going to get started.
So Chris, formal. Riz, so formal. You went with Christina. I've been Chris for the last 25 years.
Yes. Thanks for coming today. I think this is, this will be a great episode today. I enjoy having colleagues that I've worked with and peers, so we can discuss the profession and where it's going. And I think the big thing with us moving forward is how can we transform or help people understand how we're transforming healthcare and then where we all think it's going. So thanks again, Chris. Can you tell me a little bit about, your journey through, first becoming a professor at LaSalle 24 years ago and what you're doing now in your newest role?
Sure. It's hard to believe it's been 24 years. I started at LaSalle September 1st, 2000, and it was a career change at the time. I was practicing as an athletic trainer, and I was a coordinator of sports medicine at MIT and had been there for 5 years. Finished my master's at BU and really loved teaching. I was a clinical preceptor for Northeastern's program at MIT, and I wanted to teach more. So jumped into assistant professor of athletic training and the coordinator of clinical education out of the cell in 2000. Stayed in that role for about 6 years. And then it took on the program director role. At LaSalle, our program directors and program chairs, department chairs are kind of one role. You see multiple programs until, you know, we were kind of a startup. LaSalle became an accredited program in October of 2001. And when I made that transition, it was at a time where we were going through a reaccreditation process too. So, you know, just flew right into it, overseeing the program, getting it reaccredited, moving it forward, going through various iterations of accreditation, learning how to be a professor. That was the biggest transition there, was going from clinical practice to faculty, was really understanding the role of the professorate, what it means to be faculty, what it means to have an educational philosophy, how that translates to the classroom, how that translates to your students. And then kind of simultaneously, you're figuring out like, okay, and then I have to still remain kind of that clinical hat, because you're creating the future generation of clinicians, right? Love my role, but a lot of learning involved. Like really, I spent a lot of time thinking about what it means to be faculty, what it means to be in clinical practice, what it means to be an athletic training educator and an athletic training administrator, like education administrator. And then I threw in three kids in that mix. and then, you know, they keep you busy enough, right? They do. It's like nuts. You're laughing.
I know. I only have one, and that's more than enough. I mean, she's trying to get her off the damn payroll, and she's
never going to happen.
I know.
Right? I started moving into, more administrative work, more involvement at the university in different roles. I've always had a philosophy not to close any doors, even when you really hate the situation you're in. You're like, okay, can I really?
I agree.
I think every situation is an incredible learning opportunity, even if it means you learn that you don't want to do that, right? And then from there, we went through an academic affairs restructuring process in 2017. And it created an opportunity for me to become a dean. We had actually had a really flat academic structure, and the department chairs were reporting to our vice president for academic affairs. That gave me an opportunity to apply. So I applied for the dean's role. I got the job. But that was a real change, because now it was no longer about athletic training, exercise science, and the, you know, and similar programs in the dean's role. It really was, you know, my work was to oversee programs in three different buckets. So in the sciences, so forensic science, biology, biochemistry, like, you know, your traditional sciences and some applied sciences. Still had athletic training, exercise science. We had a coaching minor, some, you know, a fitness minor, like some minors in there. And then I was simultaneously developing graduate programs for the first time. So a master's in nutrition for human performance, a master's in applied sports science analytics, a master's in rehabilitation science, which has a very kind of corrective exercise kind of lens to it. And then we knew that the white paper was being drafted, and the profession was looking to move towards that graduate level. So that was kind of in my mind there. And then I was also overseeing the math area, math and data science area that supports the university under the concept of data science. Mm-hmm. So it was really super multidisciplinary. I had to really broaden my thinking. I had to understand and have a really, really strong understanding of higher ed education, being an educator. But, you know, athletic training is like, you know, it's like my heart, right?
Right.
It's like,
yeah, it is.
My
gosh,
at the end of the day, I was learning to use the athletic training skills I learned in my undergrad and in clinical practice in a really different space. Mm-hmm. And I loved it.
Yeah.
So I'd been in that role for 5-6 years. And then I had an opportunity to become an assistant provost last summer. And I did my PhD, you know, from 2016 through 2021. Mm-hmm. I learned how to become a researcher. I'm a qualitative researcher, you know, and I learned a lot about analytical thinking and different ways of building. And at the end of the day, I realized I love building things with people. I love creating academic programs of all kinds. And I really couldn't do that in an assistant provost position. Assistant provost position is, you know, you're doing a lot of, you're, You know, you're shoveling a lot of shit.
Right. Exactly.
You really are.
Yeah.
And you're doing it for the provost, right?
Right. Right.
And I wrote a large portion of our regional accreditation university self-study. So I just was like, I don't know. I'm kind of old now. I'm kind of tired of that. You know, I'm like 52, been there, done that. Don't think I want to shovel anyone's poo anymore.
Yeah.
I made a choice to go back to faculty while I think about my next move.
Mm-hmm.
And then the university was incredibly supportive and made a new job for me.
Yeah.
So they took the stuff I was doing kind of on the side as a side, you know, part of the university support, and they made it my entire job. So assistant vice president for workforce development, it's all about creating programs and developing them, but I'm doing it through the lens of co-creating programs for companies and organizations that are experiencing a dearth of workforce.
Mm-hmm.
And in that model, I had been creating the same stuff I'm doing regionally in Ireland.
Yeah.
So what I was finding is I was like running into like, you know, I'm working with politicians, I'm working with CEOs, I'm going from Dublin to Belfast to Boston. You know, I went 7 times last year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was in Grenada creating more programs. I was in I was in West Africa developing, and I thought, okay, unless I have this global engagement part to my title, these people don't take you seriously. And it was true. Like they, soon as my position shifted, it was a completely different type of work.
Yeah. And you get
sorry,
paid.
That was probably more than you wanted.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic. And I think you probably get a little bit of, you know, I guess tips in Guinness when you're over in Ireland, I'm sure. You got to start working for Guinness.
So
is Guinness part of the engagement process?
Yeah, it's everything, right? It's the food and beverage, it's the culture,
mm-hmm.
it's knowing how to navigate a different space, different types of individuals, different types of business practices,
mm-hmm.
you know? I'm typically the only woman around a table.
Yeah.
I'm typically the only woman in a room.
Yeah.
And knowing how to even navigate as a woman, and no less as a Latin woman, you know, I'm first generation US.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's this Latin woman kind of, you know, flying into these business in boardrooms and meetings, and, you know, I'm surrounded by all white men. It's just a reality.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's interesting because I talked to our current CEO for ATI Physical Therapy is a female who came from CVS Health. And it was interesting. I had a conversation with her about that. And she's like, you know, it's very interesting because when I go to a lot of these meetings for CEOs in business, I am one of the few women, if not the only woman in that boardroom. And it is sometimes daunting, but, you know, she's like, I know a lot more probably, but I'm not going to make myself, you know, I'm not going to bring that out as a person. I think the big thing for her was she said, I'm going to go with the information that I have, how I can make a difference and how I can provide better information to the people that are around the table. And I think that's important. I think, you know, culture is a big thing in different parts of the country or different parts of the world, I should say. And I know it's tough for females, especially like you said, someone that's, you know, of a different ethnic background and female, how that poses a challenge, right? But I can tell, I mean, you carry yourself very well and you're very educated and have a great way about you. So I can see you working with those people and not having too much of a problem. I guess it depends on the situation you're in. But it's interesting. You said you went to West Africa or been to West Africa. So I'd be interested to see kind of how that, you know, different culture is compared to Ireland to the US, you know. So back 25, 27, 30 years ago, why did you choose athletic training? What was it about athletic training that made you think of going into the profession?
So going back, I'm totally dating myself. So it was like, I don't know, the mid 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was always a sports junkie. I grew up in a soccer family. I am one of three, but my sister's a lot younger than I am. My dad's, you know, soccer. He's Costa Rican. My mom's Colombian.
Yeah.
You know, soccer. I mean, there was a soccer ball between my feet early on. When we moved from, so I'm originally from Southern California, And then I lived in New Mexico for 6 years before my family came over to the Boston area. But when we made the move, we moved to Milford, Mass. And Milford High School did not have a girls' soccer team.
Yeah.
So I had to pivot. But Milford High School had a full-time athletic trainer. And it was super unusual, right?
It's at that time. Yeah, in that time, right?
Mid-80s, Sandy. Her name was Sandy.
Yeah.
And Sandy, graduate of Lockhaven, the things you remember, right? Like,
yeah.
I loved it. I sprained an ankle as a freshman and ended up like kind of hanging out with her more, you know, and learning and took it all in. And I loved it. I loved, you know, the emergency care part. I love the preventative medicine part. I love the rehab part of it. And then when I graduated from Milford High, I was between a few schools. Ironically, Springfield College was not my first choice. Mm-hmm. And my number one choice, I did not get into. I got into all the other schools except my first choice. So I was like, fine, I'll go to Springfield if I have to. And clearly it was the best decision of my life. I had an incredible undergraduate experience there. Learned a lot, you know, back then. Springfield was one of the few new accredited programs. So it was like a curriculum-based accredited program. You still had to do like 1,000+ hours, like something insane. I think of some of the stuff I did. And I thought, oh my gosh, red alert.
Exactly.
Do not allow that anymore.
Yeah.
So athletic training students at Springfield back in the day, we used to cover intramural sports for the university, for the college.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah.
Well, you know, I'm, you know, 11 p.m. I'm watching and covering, right? I'm the first aider at intramural, you know, volleyball.
Right.
Where everyone has a freaking sprained ankle.
Yeah.
I chose that route. I loved it. I loved everything about athletic training. What I was learning, what I was doing, it encouraged me to take AMP like while I was in high school. And I don't know, it was like, I want to be an orthopedic surgeon. And I was like, oh my gosh, I can't pass chemistry. No way.
Yeah. It's interesting because when I was growing up in high school, I went to a vocational high school. I was going to be a carpenter.
Oh.
So I, when I was almost finished school, I remember my guidance counselor goes, you're never going to get into college. I go, I probably won't, but I'm going to try. So a really good friend of mine that, you know, him and I were like joined at the hip most of high school. And he said, well, I'm going to go. And he was going to be a painter. Like we both went to the same high school together, played football together. We went to the gym together. Like, you know, he said, I'm going to apply to go become a PT. And I'm like, okay, where are we going to go? He's like, well, let's go to Springfield and we'll go to Northeastern. And it was like our parents didn't know what we were doing. Our guidance counselor didn't have any idea. So we just drove to both places. So I said, oh, I like Northeastern. He's like, I'm going to apply here. I said, oh, I'll apply there too. So, I mean, right now, if my daughter did, I'd be like, what the heck are you doing? Like, you know, we had to be part of this whole process. And you know how it's been with your kids.
But are your parents first gen college?
First gen? No, my dad went to Northeastern, but he went nights for engineering. Mm. And I think my mother ended up having her associate's degree, I think.
I'm first generation college.
Yeah.
Too.
So for you,
so for me, it was like, they're like, what? How? Yeah, sure. Yeah, sure. Yeah. Just sign up. Ask someone at your high school. They'll help you.
Yeah. Yeah. And I had mentioned this in the last episode. I was talking to Cam Roth. He's an orthopedist in Arizona. I said, you know, I applied to Northeastern to physical therapy and they're like, you know what? We don't have a space for you, but there's this, you know, athletic training you can apply to.
Like, the default.
I'm like, okay. And then I'm like, you know what? The athletic trainer that I had in high school, he was pretty much there full time too, which was weird. It was probably 75% of position. And I'm like, that was pretty cool, like working with the athletes. So that's how I got into it. And, you know, you talked about, you know, you going back for your PhD and kind of furthering your education. And I talk to kids a lot about this. Like, your education never ends. It's always like we're building and we're trying to think of the next step in our education process. So for me, it was, I got my education as an undergrad in athletic training from Northeastern. Then I ended up getting a master's degree from there in my leadership development. And then I then went back and got a PTA degree. And this is all while I was working full time, you know, when I was working in a PT practice helping out, but then also as an athletic trainer for Westland, where I've been for 26 years. And then I went back again for my second master's in a program that you developed at LaSalle, which was sports science analytics, which for me, I was talking to you about this several years ago when this right. program started. I said, you know, I got to think of like, what's the next step for me when I step out of athletic training, whenever that is. And even before that, I can apply a lot of that degree to what I'm doing now to make sure that my athletes have the best that they can get in the process of recovery, in the process of rehabilitation, and educating them to be better in performance and then recovery. And then also help others in the field. So for me, it was always evolving. And, you know,
I think it is for a lot of athletic trainers. You know, when I meet athletic training undergrads and they're, you know, prospective students, and I say undergrads and now master's students, you know, there's an intellectual curiosity that every athletic trainer I've ever met and or anyone interested in the field has. It's mm-hmm. really fascinating. And I think that's what drives us to go in this direction, right? I think where I'd love to see athletic trainers think more broadly about is what else can you do and still in the field, right? That you're utilizing your skill set just in a different way. I think of that with my own work because at the end of the day, I've been in higher ed. I kind of laugh. I walk through the doors of Springfield campus. Mm-hmm. I went from Springfield, my first job at Bridgewater State,
yep.
my second job at MIT.
Yep.
I went to BU for my master's. I went to LaSalle to work. I went to UMass Lowell for my PhD. So I've never left a university setting. And I love a university setting. I love a lot of, you know, what it brings to a community, what it brings at large, but I don't think athletic trainers often think about like that evolution, right? And now where, you know, kind of where the world is in terms of the workforce, a lot of people our age, right? 50s are like, okay, what's next? Because I don't know if I can be blind much longer.
Yeah.
Right. But you're not done learning and you're not done working.
Correct.
So it's like you're reinventing yourself, which is actually kind of cool.
Yeah, it is. It is. And I think the relationships that you build throughout your career are very important and the people that you keep connected to. And you made a great point about, you know, not burning a bridge, like keeping everything open because you never know what's going to happen. Like you could get to a point with this, you know, what your job is right now at the university and say, you know what, I want to go back to doing what I did. Is there something that I can help to develop even further outside of that? So, I mean, there's always things that we want to keep open and people we want to keep in connection with because that's what keeps us relevant. But also you add value, I believe, mm-hmm. with a lot of that. So what do you miss most about being just the clinical athlete training professional? Like what's the biggest thing that you miss just doing that day to day, working with athletes and providing, you know, for them, I think someone in the healthcare profession that can give them some good advice, help them go through their injury process and recovery.
Well, there's no doubt that I love the type of relationships you build with your athletes. There's days I miss it. I think if my kids at home weren't athletes, right, I think I would struggle, right? I've got a baller at home and, you know, I'm constantly rehabbing her ankles, right? So it's like, okay, it just keeps me sharp, right?
Right.
But I miss a relationship with athletes. I also miss, because like in my role now, I'm not looking at like the latest research articles on, you know, certain rehab techniques or, you know, some of the, you know, evaluation, you know, scenarios. I'm not doing, my professional development is no longer really in the clinical side of things the way it used to be. And I kind of miss that. You know, I actually miss understanding and keeping up to date with some of the clinical aspects because I'm really not in clinical practice anymore at all, you know? So every so often I'll you know, get up to speed on something. And then I'm at the gym and I'm like, I don't know if you should be doing that, pal. You know,
so right. about,
my husband's like, there are trainers here, Chris, that can do that. You are like over here.
Yeah,
and I
kind
of chuckle a little bit. But I miss the relationship with athletes. I do miss actually really being at the forefront of some of the clinical practices just because I'm, you know, a curious mind. And there's something to be said for having – this can sound maybe weird, but having changes in your work day, right? Mm-hmm. Like I'm at a desk a lot. Like, you know, there's a reason why I've got like, you know, forward shoulder on the left side and freaking thoracic outlet stuff going on, right? Because I'm always like, you know, like this all day long.
It's we correct that every day. Like, even the students are like,
for sure. I'm shoulders like, back, sit up, get off the couch. Foam roller, yeah, right? Trying to open up and do open books and open up.
Right.
Like, my thoracic cavity, but
you're gonna be like, oh, you know, hunching over a cane. Why did I get shorter?
Well, and now in my new office space, I'm like dropping off like all these kind of rehab tools at everyone's doors. I'm like, you're at the computer too much, you know?
Yeah, you guys need standing desks. Do you have standing desks? That's what you need.
I don't. I usually use the kitchen counter at home. but you know, it's interesting. So I do miss that part of it. One thing that I had missed before, which I don't anymore, is the travel piece. I actually like the travel piece. I like to travel in general. And while I was in my early years, my early years at LaSalle, so from like 2000 to about 2012, I actually still worked for the U.S. Soccer Federation and for Olympic Development Soccer. So I actually got my travel fix and my clinical fix, like working with that. Mm-hmm. But when that went away, then I was just like, you know, the commute, the desk, the grind. Now that I'm traveling more, I actually do look forward to that change of scenery. So that's just me as a human. Like I need that change of scenery. I like being outside and inside and, mm-hmm. you know, it just, you kind of have to like it, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I think the one thing that I love about what I do is that, like you said, it's like this kaleidoscope of ever changing things that are going on, right?
Exactly.
So I am a clinical director for ATI physical therapy. So I'm always working with patients, communicating, helping mentor the new therapists that come in, trying to make sure that they understand what's important about communication and patient care and access to care and how that's important to everybody that calls or wants to come in. Same thing with athletes. When the athlete walks through the door, when I get a clinical student, the first thing I tell them is that person that comes through the door, ask them what they need. Because some kids come in, ninth graders, they're like a deer in the headlights. Like, what's going on here? What's this space? Like, what's going on? We have a pretty good setup at Weston where we have pretty much everything available that we need to help, you know, evaluate, treat, rehabilitate, and release the athlete back to their sport. But I think what the kids love about it the most is that you communicate and you're trying to make them feel like it's a safe zone for them. You know, it's not like they're being in a classroom and a teacher is breathing down their neck. It's like they enjoy coming in. They like the camaraderie of their other teammates and their other peers, and that they love to work to get better. And I think that's important because it's an ever-changing landscape that we see. And I think it makes it important. And it's always interesting and exciting for me, and I'm sure other athletic trainers that are in the industry. The one thing you mentioned is the grind. I mean, it is. I mean, there's days that you're there very late. You're there on weekends. You might be there during a holiday week when the school vacation. And at times we've been doing it for a long time. It's like, oh, like, when is this going to end? When do I really try to make a shift and a pivot? But I'm still enjoying it to the point where I can see that there's going to be an end game, but it's, you know, not anywhere in the near future.
I think you bring up like a really great point, and that is you still enjoy it, right? Mm-hmm. So, and that's how I felt in all the roles I've ever had. I've always known exactly when it's time to find something different.
Yeah.
In the role, you know, being the dean of the School of Health Sciences, I love the classroom. Yeah. I actually still was required to teach one class a semester, and I like that was my like sanctuary. Like, I would walk into the classroom like, all right guys, let's go, you know.
Yeah.
Like, it was like awesome, and you're imparting information and you're collaborating with your students and you're doing work in a way that's like, okay, I am reminded why I love what I'm doing. And then it's like, you know, then I'm dealing with the personnel management like down the hallway, right?
Yeah. So the eagerness to get back in the classroom and those kids to be like, hey, Professor Haverty, like, right, you know, they enjoy it.
Right.
As much as you do.
And I actually really, another part of like that is I love, you know, advising. I actually like academic advising. Some mm-hmm. people don't enjoy that part of the job because, you know, all faculty really have to have an academic advising load. And I loved it. I actually, because I always felt that one-on-one was a chance to do some mentoring, to provide some guidance. And I take a very, I guess the position I hold and I take in terms of the way I advise is thinking from the perspective of like, well, if this was my kid, right? Mm-hmm. What kind of person would I want on the other end, right? Working with them. You always hope that there's a sound guidance from an adult figure that really could help provide that. So I love the academic advising piece. Those are, in my new role, some of the pieces that I actually kind of miss. Mm-hmm. I'm not on the academic side of the house. What I don't miss is the personnel management. That is, when you're leading a team of 30 to 50 people, depending on any given year between full-time and part-time, it's a lot, right? You know, it's like you're just putting out fires all day long, 8 to 5, 8 to 6. And then I get to sit down and do my work.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And that's got to be challenging too for you because, you know, like you said, you're someone that's always want to be moving and doing. And like, it's almost like as that in that position, it was like the shit rolls downhill almost. Like you have to pick it up, pick the pieces up, and try to deal with it. So it can be daunting and challenging, I'm sure.
Well, you do find yourself the type of mentoring you're doing also shifts from that student to the faculty. Young faculty, junior faculty have very different needs than a veteran faculty member. Mm-hmm. However, that veteran faculty member still needs mentoring and support in a different way. So just knowing how to navigate the mentoring kind of spectrum from the freshman that walks through your door to the senior, to the grad student, through your junior faculty to your veteran faculty, and balancing it in a way that you're still meeting all the demands of your job, they become challenging.
Yeah. Where do you think, I mean, putting your athletic training hat back on and actually professor, and chairperson hat, where do you think the profession's going? I think there's this, I guess the healthcare landscape is ever changing, and we hear stuff about PAs now. Are they going to go away and nurse practitioners are taking over? Like, and we see the physical therapy space moving into more of the athletic training realm as some organizations, colleges, and professional sports are hiring ATPT sports scientists. I think there's always going to be a place for athletic training. I don't think it's going anywhere. But given the cost of education, how that varies across the spectrum of universities and colleges, which is absurd to be, I mean, because I had to deal with that with my daughter recently.
I'm paying college tuition too, believe me.
Now she's in grad school, which is even worse. But anyway, that's a story for another day. I think where it's going and then the return on the investment is astounding. And I think it's kind of a two-part question. Like, where do you think athletic training is going and how do you provide an education that is meaningful, that is valuable, and that is going to pay off? But then how do we get those salaries to increase? Because we've been talking about this for 20, 30 plus years about bringing salaries up for athletic trainers and the value they provide. So can you speak a little to that? And I know it's a long question, but I'm sure you can kind of, I can see the wheels turning there.
Well, that's the thing. I'm trying to think about where to start.
Yeah.
Let me start with cost of education, okay? Because I've been in higher ed for so long. And there's no doubt that I think as consumers of education, right, prospective students, you have to do your due diligence and see really what makes the most sense for you fiscally. But I also think that people don't think about the investment the way they probably should, right? Okay. So for example, I think to myself, so my husband's an attorney.
Yeah.
Right. And someone's like, oh my gosh, you paid for all those law school bills, which was like obscene, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
But he couldn't have his career without it.
Correct.
And he has made that money, 10 times over.
Yeah.
Right. So then I always think like, okay, how much how much is someone going to spend on X amount of education? Right. And what value does that hold long term? Right. So I decided to invest in a PhD later in life, right? Does it really? And my employer did not require me to do it. I would have been fine at my job for the rest of my life.
Just your overachieving self wanted to become.
Well, and I had a professional goal and it's a trajectory. Yeah. But the reality of it is that for me, I knew I was going to work for at least another 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I sure the hell wasn't going to die at the desk I was sitting at.
Mm-hmm.
And because I chose a career in higher ed, and quite frankly, my jobs have always been really PhD required. I just didn't have it. And I got the job anyways. I was going to make that money back over and over. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And more importantly, it made me eligible for higher paying jobs.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So I think about athletic training and the move from undergrad to grad, right? I still support that move. I think it was the right thing to do. And part of it is understanding how undergrad works, right? When you're trying to meet the demands of the core curriculum or the general electives, your regular electives, and then your discipline-specific courses, we would have forever had to have been pigeonholed into a very limited skill set because you just didn't have enough time within the 120 credits or, you know, 125 credits, whatever, 126, whatever it comes out to for some universities to get all of what we feel is, you know, are the standards in which an athletic trainer must know. And I'm shifting nomenclature around because throughout the years it shifted. Mm-hmm. Now, when I think about some of our athletic training master's degree students, the skill set that they're coming in with is pretty interesting, right? They actually have some foundational knowledge in a way that actually has been really fascinating and allows you to get through content quicker in a different way, right? They also come in with a kind of like knowledge base that our undergrads never had, right? Whether it's a background in exercise science or whether it's a background in strength and conditioning or their knowledge of kinesiology and biomechanics, whatever it happens to be, or someone that is a change, right? Someone's a sport management bachelor's that decides to go kind of the athletic training route.
Yeah.
The skill set's pretty interesting, mm-hmm. right? You also have someone that has developed their critical thinking patterns. You go to the master's level, now you can lean in harder. Yeah. Right. So I do think we are educating a future generation of really high level athletic trainers. Mm-hmm. Not to say that we weren't great, right, Riz?
Right.
But at the end of the day, it took us that much longer to get to that way of thinking.
Right.
Right. So do you get the value back when you're paying, whatever it costs now for a master's degree? Let's say you're paying, you know, $50,000 for a 2-year degree, right?
Yeah.
And you already did 4 years of undergrad.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. So we can add that up. It's pretty big, right?
Yeah.
Are you getting your value back, the money back? Well, you wouldn't have been able to get your job as an athletic trainer. Okay, now let's shift towards what I think about our pay as a profession. I think I think as a profession, for whatever reason, and this is not the blame game, this isn't anything. We haven't done a great job of establishing our value, mm-hmm. right? And for me, it has nothing to do with third-party billing, none of that.
Yeah.
And the only reason I use that term is because I know for a fact what some strength and conditioning coaches make at university and professional levels. And believe me, there's no third-party billing there, right?
Yeah.
So I think, and I don't know why, right? Is it that we've always tried to be the jack of all trades and be the generalist and not the specialist, or maybe that generalist is of greater value now, mm-hmm. you know? I don't know what it is, but for whatever reason, that value hasn't been acknowledged and identified. Mm-hmm. I'm going to give you a little anecdote to make you chuckle, right? I was literally in the process of giving birth to my third child, okay? Till I tell you this.
Yeah.
It was a very strange experience.
An aha moment.
I hope your viewers appreciate this. Right?
Yes, I'm sure they will.
Okay. Baby number three,
yeah.
Three high-risk pregnancies, bed rest with all of them. My preemies range between 28 weeks gestational age with my youngest to 30. I went the longest with my third. So I had her at like 35 weeks. So she was like pretty much fully cooked, right?
Yeah.
So, but she was an emergency C-section.
Okay.
Right? Same OB with all of them, high-risk Brigham and Women's.
Yeah.
Okay? So literally... Yeah, curtains up. I'm getting sliced open. Husband's here cheering me on. Epidural's kicked in. You know, they're working on finding the kid.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's chatting. Happens to be my OB chatting with the other physician or PA or whoever was in the room.
Yeah.
You know, don't remember. I was trying to kind of not think.
Yeah.
And he goes, he plops his head over kind of like above and goes,
yeah.
Hey, Christina, so what do you do for a living? Wait, what are you? Because every time we have an appointment, you know everything I'm talking about.
Yeah.
You know exactly what I'm saying and why this and that. I go, I'm an athletic trainer. Now, I always self-identify as an athletic trainer.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
No matter what my, at the time, I was a department chair and program director. And he's like, oh yeah. He goes, so I could hear him speaking to his colleague.
Yeah.
Like, she knows all this stuff.
Yeah.
And she's an athletic trainer.
Yeah.
She knows all the Gen Men stuff and she knew this and that. And he was so shocked, right? And you could tell in the tone of his voice and talking to his colleague, right? Which just made me chuckle because I thought, how come no one knows what we can do?
Right.
How come nobody understands how valuable of a clinician we really are?
Yeah, correct.
Right?
Correct.
At work, I'd get called, you know, I would get called the president because I hurt my ankle. Can you help me out?
Yeah.
The provost. Okay, my blood sugars are slightly off and I did this and that. I'm like, well, like it's so interesting. And I have to tell you, I think because I've always worked really well in trying to promote us as these healthcare professionals and clinicians that work with a healthy population, that it has earned the respect on our campus.
Yeah.
So when we went to the transition to a master's, no hesitation. When the numbers were dropping in enrollment, okay, little hesitation, but I was able to push back, right?
Yeah.
Now our numbers are on the they're climbing. And there's never, ever, ever a doubt as to why we have a program or why we've continued to grow.
Yeah. No, that was great. I think the one thing that I look back to, and you talk about everybody asking you for advice because they know what you do and what we do as athletic trainers. The general public doesn't know much about what we do,
they
right?
Don't get
it. I think I think it's tough unless you had, and I think it's definitely changed and it's transitioned over the years because when I first started, nobody knew. They thought we were horse trainers, like dog trainers,
weight trainers.
Yeah,
right?
And now a lot of their kids, they have gone through as athletes, and their kids have, so they now know. So it's a little bit better now. But I remember, Chad Starkey was our program director at Northeastern, and he would always say to us about education. To go back to the education piece. He's like, just remember this. I don't care if you pass your exam, that is entry level. It's right. Like, and I always tell kids, think of when you put the bumpers up on a bowling alley so your ball can't go down the gutter. That just gives you a clear path to be able to practice at entry level. And now if you put the gutters down, you can now veer off and become more educated. So I think you have to just keep that in the back of your mind is that how do we get better? We want to promote ourselves. We educate. And it was really interesting to me this past year at the Board of Allied Health. We went through that whole process of continuing ed for PTs. Mm-hmm. PTs and OTs did not need continuing ed in the state of Mass for education to continue to practice, I should say. Mm-hmm. And it was one of three states. And we're always like, what the heck was? And finally, the way that it was written, the definitions of continuing ed and what it meant, it ended up getting passed. So now it just puts the onus on the professional to further educate themselves, which a lot of people were, but I think the older part of the population in that profession was not doing what they needed to do. So we get a lot of questions now on, you know, well, what do I have to, how many hours do I need? What do I need to do? And it goes back to the whole hours thing we talked about, which is totally separate with going through traditional athlete training programs. And they got to do 2,400 hours at Northeastern.
But no,
crazy.
I will say that is as much as people get frustrated with where the profession has gone to the master's level, there's something to be said, and we should be proud of our willingness to evolve as a profession. Because some don't, right?
Yeah.
And the way, think about it, if you don't evolve, you die.
Yeah. Right? You need to keep moving.
Literally.
Yeah.
Evolution is necessary for life.
Yeah. And that's the one thing that I've kept continuing my education because, like I said before, like I'm looking 10, 15 years down the road. How can I continue to be relevant? And that's sports science, healthcare advisement, mm-hmm. and then doing mm-hmm. some of that stuff with some of the younger populations or even organizations. So for me, I can step out of the traditional role and the management role and then still do that. So for me, it was always like the rate of return on investment for education for me. I knew that if I spaced this out for 15, you know, if I end up going back for another master's degree or even the first one, I knew that was going to pay off over so many years for me. And that's the way I looked at it. So my talking to young professionals or young students, my advisement to them is it will pay off at some point. It's going to take time. So don't look at it right now. And I think there's some young professionals that come out even, you know, in other professions where they're like, I want to be making $150,000 a year. I'm like, that doesn't happen out of the gate. And it might not happen. Like, you have to understand, like, you have to evolve and make yourself relevant to the point where you're making a difference to open up other doors for you down the road. But again, like you said before, don't burn the bridge that you're already on, because that then creates problems down the road for you.
It's funny. You just said something that made me think about it. We have to think that evolution piece is interesting, but that also might look different for like I kind of laughed. So recently I said to my husband, I go, I feel like I should go get an MBA. And he was like,
why?
Chris, we're all done with school.
Yeah.
We're paying college tuition now. You're not going back. I'm like, no. I think this would be really good for me. Like, and he's like, no more homework. Yeah. No more being in a coffee shop to draft a project or a capstone.
Yeah. When we go on vacation, you can just relax on vacation.
But it's for me, it's now in my new role. It's so business oriented. Yeah. So of course I'm teaching myself business planning and P&L, creating P&Ls, right? Yeah.
P&Ls are very fun, by the way. No, they're not.
No, this is what I did like a couple of weeks ago, and I was kind of laughing. I'm like, but I think it speaks to I think I crave that challenge, right? The intellectual challenge. And I think a lot of athletic trainers do. But you also mentioned, you made a comment about your sports science degree, your applied sports science analytics degree. And I'll tell you, I know people are like, you know, PTs. I don't know. I think it's been going on for a while, and I don't know how many individuals in our profession are really paying attention to what that sports science analytics piece and that sports scientist is doing in terms of creeping into our spaces, you can say, you know, our profession in a way. They're... People are underestimating the role that data and that sports science analytics piece is playing in our work. And again, another skill set to think about, right? Once upon a time, it was like the PT thing, and I'm not saying that's gone away. I think there's plenty of work for all of us. There really is.
Yep.
But I do think athletic trainers have to think of their evolution and how that sports science piece comes into play, in addition to, of course, some of the other pieces like healthcare, like public health. Why aren't athletic trainers at the forefront of public health?
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, that brings me to the question of, you know, it sounds like, I mean, if you look at PT, AT, sports science, like how do we coexist to be able to, for the betterment of the patient or the athlete? So it sounds like, you know, we all need to play together in the sandbox and play nicely in order for it to work. And, you know, I find a lot of, you know, it's interesting being an athletic trainer, but also just not just, but being a PTA, like I'm a clinical director and I've been doing this for a long time, but PTs that have come out and that have worked for me in my space still come and ask me questions about clinical care, you know, because they know that, you know, the outcomes have been good. We provide great care across the board, but we all lean on each other to make sure that we're doing the best for the patient. And the same with the athlete. Like I still call on friends that are athletic trainers about something. If I have a problem with somebody, like, hey, you know, if you've had this type of case, like what did you find worked? And I think that's important because we can then bounce things off of each other. And I do like to be able to provide the best education or feedback to the physical therapist that I work with, or even the other PTAs I work with. So we all can work together to make sure we come to the best decision for that person. So where do you think that fits in, like as far as athletic training moving forward or in the curriculums now, is that being like, how is that discussed on working with others in the healthcare profession and how to coexist?
So it's, you know, it's in the standard. So IPE, so interprofessional education, and IPP, interprofessional practice, is part of the standards. So there is a requirement really for program directors to intentionally create curricula around working with others, right? The question becomes, who are the others, right? So PT is clearly there, right? But there's other health profession, you know, health professionals to consider, you know, and are they really being brought in? Work with OTs. Like I know when we at LaSalle, when we started to look at some interprofessional education opportunities, you know, we got a lot more resistance from PTs who were like, but the OTs, they were super excited about working together, right? Nurses, right? Understanding. I still can't in my mind understand how at the secondary school level, most schools, the nurse doesn't communicate with the athletic trainer.
How are
we not looking at our student athletes for going from the transition from the school day to the after school?
Yep.
How is that not a seamless, like, healthcare opportunity?
Right.
To include your athletic trainer as part of your the nursing staff or the medical staff, however they want.
Yeah.
It's all collaboration, but those silos are still so heavily rooted and historically been, you know, kind of kept. But it's nuts, right? I'm laughing too, because I just signed up my kids for spring sports. And it's
which,
like,
starts Monday.
Which starts Monday, right? Don't forget that the physical form must be uploaded to the portal because the athletic trainer doesn't have access to the nurse's portal where they sit. And I'm like, insanity.
Yeah, it's crazy, right?
It's insane. And then I can't figure out if it's just like shitty systems, or is it like literally because people just don't want to, or does the nurse not even know that we have an athletic trainer, which sadly is probably part of the problem, right?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's interesting. We've talked about this for decades, right? And I think I've been pretty fortunate at Weston. All the nurses that we've had close relationships to. We've always talked about the athlete. When we developed the concussion protocol back in 2012, when the state went through the mandate, we sat down and helped write the process for the return to play. And we always communicated back and forth. If someone had a head injury in school, they would communicate to me back and forth, injuries that they need to look for coming into the office in the morning when I wasn't there. And then most recently, my wife is now the nurse there. She's been there for 7 years.
Oh.
So for her and I, we obviously live together. We talked about athletes and students when I go into work during the day. So we meet every day. Hey, who'd you see? Who do I need to know about, or who I saw the night before? So we keep it at work. We don't take it home. And the other key thing is that our nurse leader and I have collaborated on a few things that have been fantastic. One, the EAPs for the school. How do we deal with heat exhaustion, heat illness, and rectal thermometry, which is a big thing that people don't want to touch because of high school settings, but it's best practices, right? So we end up bringing in, we had an education session with Corey Stringer Institute last summer, brought in the whole fire department. We brought in the nurses. We brought in the coaches. We brought in the AD was there. And we all sat down and we went over this protocol. This is how it's going to work. This is how we're writing it into our practice. And everybody stamped it and said, perfect. We want the best for the athlete. We want to make sure we're up with best practices. So those type of things for us have been great, but it's not happening everywhere. And how do we do it? And people really have a hard time because they feel like, well, what's the boundary here? Well, there is no boundary. We're healthcare professionals providing best practices for the athletes we care for every single day.
Together,
period. And that's it. End of story. So it is. I think there's got to be a lot more education that's provided, but I also think it's a top-down approach, right? I think in schools, it's got to come from the superintendent, from the school committee, from the lead nurse or the lead healthcare provider that's looking over, which is the physician, then the nurse leader, then the nurses in the schools, athletic trainers, all collaborating together. And you need your athletic director's support too. If you don't have that, you're not getting anywhere. So it's important.
I mean, I don't know. I'm not up to date with this information, but I don't know if there has been any explicit research done and or work on that type of model. I don't know. I haven't looked it up. And if it's out there, you know, how has not something like that not been stamped as kind of best practices? And I know interprofessional education is like a really huge topic.
Mm-hmm.
It is part of the standards in the athletic training education programs. And there is, there's a very, you know, specific effort on behalf of the accreditation to make sure that that's covered. But checking that box and the reality of it translating to putting in functional models in secondary school systems, whole other conversation, right?
Right.
And getting people on board to understand that, but there's a reason. Like I said, I mentioned the public health piece because, you know, athletic trainers have such an amazing skill set that can actually be used in public health for individuals, you know, in your community, right? And if you think about it, your public schools, if you have an athletic trainer there, the children, right, the students, student athletes, they're getting their, you know, athletic trainers is that first line of healthcare. You're that kind of initial piece, you know, primary
you
care,
are,
right?
Yeah.
And you're the one that's really identifying initial issues and mitigating issues. But also, and it depends on the demographics and the school district that you're in, but sometimes those student athletes are coming home with that information.
Yeah.
Right. And that information becomes like healthcare, right, for moms and dads at home or grandparents or extended families, depending. Yeah. So there's like this bigger piece where the athletic training role can serve as part of a healthcare team in, you know, in public health and so forth. So I don't know. I could, believe me, in my role as a dean, I just learned to really look at things like broader.
Yep.
And had a bird's eye view. And it's just so much easier for me to see where there's holes, not to negate the fact that I think athletic trainers are doing amazing work in other ways. Right.
Yeah.
You know, you're in the trenches, you're on the ground, you're watching things happen. So it's interesting. I have, I get frustrated and then I get really excited when you see great things happening and you just kind of, and then, you know, you talk to your OBGYN who's saying, hey, it's great. You know, all this stuff.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I'm like, this is a really weird conversation right now.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think it's important because you have to think about who you're collaborating with daily. And I think it's getting out there and having those important mentors for you and for your students, but also for the people that you're working with. Like, how do you build those relationships within the orthopedics around in the area? How you refer out? How do you have direct access to care, whether it's orthopedics, whether it's to physical therapy? If you don't have the capacity or the span to treat that person in traditional setting. I find it very important, but I think one of the messages that I try to spread the most, even with physical therapists, is you have to build those relationships to make yourself known as the person you are and the professional that you are. So I don't know how it's being taught in the graduate level right now. I don't know if there's a lot of around it. I know that clinical education is a big piece and you build those relationships. Some people are very uncomfortable talking to physicians, I find, or going out and trying to build a relationship with a physician. But the reason why, if I look back to my journey, I found that all the relationships that I built came from really a couple of orthopedics and then all the fellows that they had along the way that worked with me. And now we have such a great relationship that I can text any physician in any discipline to get an athlete in, and they're in that day, next day, that within that week, without question. And I think it's important, and it tells us a lot, that if you build the relationships and they understand what you can provide as an athletic trainer or a physical therapist, then you're doing the right thing for your patient or for your athlete. As far as mentorship, I didn't really talk about it, but I mentioned it. Where do you think that fits in the process of education? And how do you think that fits moving forward for somebody that's already out in the profession?
Well, start where it fits in the education process. Mentoring for me, it's like day one,
right?
Right. You have to decide what the vehicle for mentoring is, right? There's some obvious mentoring relationships that exist, and then some are a little less obvious. You know, individuals tend to gravitate to people they look up to or feel a connection or are new approachable. So sometimes, you know, there's a more organic way of mentoring happening, and there's sometimes a more intentional way of it happening. But, you know, in the education process, it should start with your academic advisor, without a doubt. I think program directors and faculty have this really amazing opportunity to choose to be a good mentor, right?
Mm-hmm.
But not all people choose that, right? Some people don't like it. It's really interesting. So that's in a program. So I've always encouraged students to identify an individual, a faculty member, a staff member that could be a mentor to them, right? And then you see if that, you can't force a mentor. I don't think you can force mentorship.
Mm-hmm.
I think there has to be some kind of a connection in some way, shape, or form. I think in my experience, my undergrad experience, a great relationship with our program director, and I, you know, he was an incredible mentor, as he was to many others over the years. But then I had other types of mentoring relationships with some of the GAs,
mm-hmm.
right, at the time, who end up being faculty later on, right? You know, my first boss was an amazing mentor, the dean that I worked for. So there's different spaces where that happens. Sometimes a mentor could just be like even an upperclassman or someone, or, you know, someone that's a year ahead of you, but maybe they're like really an older adult. We've had some more experience in older adults in our program. But then So that's one piece of it. But then that needs to be fostered through the years, right? That needs to, and I don't think mentoring's an interesting thing, right? Students are very cognizant of the fact that if you don't have time for them or and you don't take the time to create that relationship, they're not going to trust you. And for me, trust has to, that establishing trust is what establishes the mentoring process for me, right? They have to be able to trust you, even if it's just a little bit initially, and then you grow the trust, right?
Yeah.
I think one of the places that is a missed opportunity in mentoring is once an individual transitions out into practice, right? And if I, in a utopian environment, if I was able to do this, I would love to create a mentoring program at the university that an individual graduated from so that the alums can come back and continue that mentoring. Because when you're dealing with young professionals and they're off into that first job and they don't have a mentoring system at that first employer, it's a struggle. I think people struggle to want to remain in the profession because they don't have a good experience. They struggle to want to keep it at that, employment there. So I almost wish that there was an environment where the university creates a mentorship program for their alums so that in those initial, for the first 5 years when you're trying to, kind of figure it out, there's a place to come back. My alums know, they know where to find me.
Right.
I'm pretty sure they all have my cell number. They all know. I tell them all the time, just come back. I'll answer a question. I'll point you. I don't have all the answers. I'll point you in the right direction. I'll use my professional network to leverage an opportunity for you.
Yeah. Yeah.
That doesn't exist everywhere. Not, at least not in a formal way.
Yeah. I think I try to do the same. No question I always say is a dumb question or a stupid question. I feel like if we've lived it, we're going to help share it and help to make sure it's easier for the next generation to go through and be successful. And I go back to, I think a lot of young professionals coming out feel the stress levels here, but they feel like they can't navigate it. They can't be able to absorb that stress level and how to use that in a positive way. And I feel like we've lived all of that and we've done it. And I wouldn't ask somebody to do something I've never done before. Mm-hmm. So if I'm asking you to do it, it means that I've done it, but I want you to get better at doing it to be better as a professional. And I think the mentoring piece, I still have mentors that I go to all the time. Mm-hmm. I just met with one. Actually, Carl was my first episode. He's still a big mentor to me and I always go to him for stuff. So for me, I'm always learning. And if there's something I am just confused about, I'll say, hey, Carl, have you dealt with this? And to me, I think mentorship's ever evolving. And it's just to make sure that you're setting the expectation for the people that are working with you or below you, or even, the peers that you work with on a daily basis. So I think it is very important. But I like your idea about bringing it to the university. I think that would be very impactful. So it looks like you have some homework to do.
Like I needed to add that to my plate, right? I've been really lucky. My first job, I had a great first boss, Keaton Polinchek. She was the head athletic trainer at Bridgewater years ago. I left there and I went to MIT, and we really didn't have leadership at MIT at the time I was there. But I had three colleagues. We all started at the same time. Mm-hmm. And with my time at MIT was about leveraging your colleagues' expertise in a way that allowed you to evolve professionally and personally.
Yeah.
So my time in MIT was like all about relationship building with my peers. And as a group, we basically ran the department.
Yeah.
And I had some amazing, to this day, still really close to the people, the athletic trainers I was on the staff there over those 5 years. And then in LaSalle, it was really interesting because my boss, the program chair really, at the time when I first started, was never a mentor for me, ever. He actually, I think, saw me more as an adversary.
Okay.
As as more like I became his nemesis, I think. And then that evolved into like we just became coworkers and we were good. But what was interesting for me is, like, you know, it was the dean that was my mentor, but she left and then the dean structure went away. Mm-hmm. And then I found myself in a space really with no mentor for about 10 years, like a solid 10 years. And it was really a couple of hours. So sorry.
That's okay. Oh my
God. Dog just went insane. So sorry.
That's okay.
And I really, and I went a few years where really it was more about finding a trusted colleague.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
My PhD was different though. Very interesting. Like, I met a faculty member who, in my second year, third year, maybe third, who said, "I want to be your mentor." And I'm like, "Yes."
Yeah.
I'm like,
right.
And I was, and we like super clicked right away. He was, the way he thought was really good for me. The way I needed him. I never knew I needed him in a role of mentor and really dissertation chair, which ultimately he became. But then I had other faculty mentors in that space.
Yeah.
Now my new boss, he's more of a mentor, and my boss right before him, my last two bosses have been much more mentors for me than I had ever thought I. And I'm thinking, I'm like, okay, I'm now like in my 50s, right? I had a boss for 3 years. So the university president, I was a direct report of his when he was provost.
Okay.
And he was just an amazing, he taught me a totally different way of thinking and being that was very, very useful and helpful for me to evolve. My current boss, same way, different way of thinking, different way of supervising, very much a mentor.
Yeah.
So it's been really interesting. And I will say most of my mentors have been men.
Okay.
I know that's like a weird thing maybe to say. I have not been able to find a very good female mentor, and or have other than one, and that was the dean years ago, 15 years ago.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Weird. Yeah, interesting. To close out, what advice do you have for aspiring students that are becoming athletic or want to become an athletic trainer? Or even for that new grad, what is some of the advice you have for them on being successful or, you know, being able to get through, I guess, the day-to-day as an athletic trainer?
So I guess I'll start by saying that we're past the days of the type of grind that probably you and I went through, in that young professionals are coming in with different expectations, right? Yeah. And those expectations have been, sometimes they're a little unrealistic, right?
Yeah.
I think, so I have a few things I would kind of advise someone going into the profession. So I do think we need to keep an open mind, right? I've talked to a lot of young professionals and or just new grads who are like, well, I'm not doing this or I'm not doing that. Like, I'm really not sure. Like, if it's in the job description, it's kind of part of your job.
Right.
I think there needs to be kind of like a reality check on what's your job and what's the reality of, like, if you don't do that, you know, you're insubordinate, right? Like, literally.
Correct.
So I do think there's this managing expectations that needs to take place, right? I also think that some individuals just go look for a job.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to be employed, and then I'll deal with whether I like it later, right?
Yeah.
And I think people have to be a little bit more intentional about working for an organization that they actually align with from a values perspective.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think people are as intentional about that as they should be. And I say that just thinking about a fresh grad, you know, there. I'll get a student saying like, well, I'm applying to anything. I'm like, see, you may want to do that, but look at the mission of the organization. Think about do you really want to work for that company? Do you really want to work for that university? Do you really even believe in what they do and their mission? So I do think, you know, you got to keep an open mind, right? You have to make sure that you're aligning things with really the values of the organization you want to work for. Otherwise, it's not going to last.
Yeah.
Right. I also think that for that first job, it's not intended to be forever. At the end of the day, even though I've been at LaSalle for 24 years, I had two other full-time jobs before that.
Yeah.
That first job really should be a stepping stone. It should be a 2 to 5 year window, because you need to learn to evolve. And the only way you can do that is by being exposed to different environments.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that was well said. I mean, I think that's what we're seeing with a lot of the younger professionals, that they might come in if we're investing in that person, or if they need to stay a little longer. Because I was always thinking of, you know, for me, it's different. Like, I'm a dinosaur. I've been at the same physical therapy practice, you know, for 28 years in the same space. Obviously, we were acquired, you know, 8 years ago. But then I was at Emmanuel College, Boston Latin School for 2 years. And it was, as long as they're evolving and getting better and understand the landscape of it, I think it's important that they kind of hear it from, you know, from you being in that position of educating and advising, and then for them from their peers, which is important. So very good. Well, thanks, Chris.
Hey, thanks for having me. This is great.
I think it was great. Hopefully we get a lot of likes and people, you know, get a lot out of this talk. I think there was a lot of good information there, especially kind of the way that you evolved through your career. And we'll catch up again.
Sounds great. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Chris.
Yeah, great to see you. Take care.
Thank you for tuning in to Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast. This is your creator and host, Andrew Rizza. If you enjoyed the content from today's episode, give us a like, leave a comment, and share on social media. You can find us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow us on Instagram at Behind Sports Med Podcast, on X under AJR Sports Sci, or check out our websites at ajrsportscience.podbean.com and at ajrsportscience.com. You can also subscribe to our YouTube channel at AJR Sports Science. Stay tuned for our next episode.